Trump would tell me this in what we might call sotto voce. Like, don't tell anybody. I'm like, it's okay. Everything is, you know, in Uber, anything goes. You don't have to worry about it. I think that the demographic changed and the vote count changed as the summer progressed until by the time we rolled around to September, it was almost even down the middle, about 50-50 Trump and Clinton. And what particularly surprised me was the number of African Americans who supported Trump, the number of Hispanics who supported Trump. I even had a Muslim passenger who told me that she supported Trump. And, you know, that kind of goes against conventional wisdom for sure. It's obviously we would assume that that people would be for Hillary, but yet at the same time, it seems to me that that Trump's natural constituency would be minorities, working people, blue collar workers. Now that we're reaching the end of the election season and we're only 4 days away, the pendulum seems to have swung back and it looks like it's overwhelmingly in favor of Clinton. Perhaps there's a closing, I guess, and this is Massachusetts, of course. I don't know if it's a reflection of the rest of the country, but there's a closing maybe here in that people are looking for some kind of a continuity. Let's not forget that President Obama is very highly rated in Massachusetts. So there's an idea that having Clinton is a known entity, even if people don't necessarily like that known entity. Nevertheless, it is a definable entity, that there would be nothing radically changing with Clinton. It would be a continuance of Obama, which most people in the state like, or at least they think they like, maybe more for cultural reasons than anything real. And so there is a kind of a retrenchment, a sort of a move back into the fold for Hillary Clinton. I think that in these final waning days of the election, where the momentum is certainly for Trump, nevertheless, if Clinton is to overcome that momentum, that's going to be the force that brings that about. At least if we're talking conventional popular politics here, let's put aside the question of voter fraud. That's a different topic. And that would be that the American people will decide that they do not want to risk any kind of change, and that certainly Hillary Clinton is going to try to portray Trump as a radical change, but rather that they want a continuation of the status quo, even if that status quo is not that interesting and not that dynamic. At least, you know, it's a known entity. You know, we're kind of like the proverbial frog in the petri dish. We've gotten used to a certain temperature. And even though it's not healthy necessarily, and even though we're being used as a scientific experiment, nevertheless, we are used to that temperature. And we're living in it, so we become kind of immune to the negative aspects of it, and we want to continue that feeling. So, I think in that context, Hillary Clinton, and I think that's really the only context that she could possibly reverse the trend toward Trump. But in that context, she could at least begin to establish enough of a polarity to win the election. But clearly, the momentum is right now with Donald Trump. So, I will ask our listeners here at Tufts University, what say you? 855-915-9636. Come on down. 855-915-9636. So, what has been the driving force of the election? And I suppose this is where I'm going to begin to put a few cards on the table here. I think that Donald Trump has referred to himself in these waning weeks as the Brexit candidate, the candidate that's going to bring about a major break with the status quo, with how business has been done. Now, I don't know if I surely probably don't need to remind my Tufts University listeners here what Brexit is, because you guys are the smartest people in the world, which is why I'm doing this show here. I'm hoping to cultivate, by the way, as I develop a program, and I'm a veteran radio host. I actually did a show here about 20 years ago, and I'm thrilled to be back. But I'm going to be developing, hopefully, a program that serves the Tufts community, the students, the professors, the teachers, the intellects, people over at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. I want to bring people in to discuss issues, because I think that Tufts represents a spawning ground for the future influence makers, the rulers, the change agents in this country, people who are going to be at the top of their fields, whether they be in the public or private sector, whether they be in government, whether they be in academia, business, wherever. Tufts University is one of the nation's top universities. So to my way of thinking, by doing a broadcast here and by servicing the Tufts community, I am sitting in the epicenter of one of the intellectual generators of the future. So I'm looking forward to talking about all sorts of issues, not just politics, but science, health, culture, economy, philosophy, religion, law, controversy, you name it. I want to get into it, and I want to take a measure of what people are thinking and what people are feeling, because I think it reflects, clearly does reflect, not only the opinions and attitudes of academia and students and college students around the country, but the country as a whole. So in that line, I'd like to again ask listeners here, what say you? The election's only 4 days away. Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton? Who are you with? 855-915-9636. 855-915-9636. Come on down. Now, I would again, getting back to the topic of Trump characterizing himself as the Brexit candidate. Brexit, of course, was a shock to not only the United Kingdom, but to the world, when the people of England and of Britain voted to exit their nation from the European Union. All the establishment was against it. Both major parties were against it. The media was against this. They wanted to keep England in. They portrayed people who opposed this as some kind of buck-tooth Neanderthal, you know, really a nasty, you know, portrayal of anyone who didn't agree. And they completely scoffed and dismissed them and saying that this isn't going to happen. The polls coming out a couple of days before the Brexit vote indicated that it was going nowhere. I remember seeing on television a clip of John Oliver, the late night talk show host, do a really scornful attack on people who wanted Brexit, wanted to exit the European Union. And I think that that reflected the attitude of the establishment in England. And yet, Brexit won handily. And what Brexit did, and I think what Brexit meant, was that the British people wanted to reassert their nation's sovereignty, both in principle and in fact. And I would contend that this was a progressive move. This is a good thing. The development of the nation state is not something that happened overnight. It's something that evolved over 1,000 years. And that what it is that when people come together and establish sovereign nationhood, they are establishing their right to determine their own government, their own destiny, their own ability to have a government that reflects their values. It's a democratic idea. And Great Britain and the British people were finding, and this was admitted by the pro-EU people as well, and they, of course, said, well, we're going to solve this. We're going to find a way around it. But they were admitting that regulations coming in from Brussels, which was where the European Union is headquartered, were such that they were interfering in all aspects of the lives of the citizens of Britain. Their health, their welfare, their education, their conduct in business, their government's engagement in foreign wars and diplomacy, and other aspects. And it was becoming onerous because people were realizing that they didn't have much of a say over these regulations. You know, there were regulations coming down telling them how to bring up their children. There were regulations dealing with the criminal justice system that were not necessarily supported by the people. And the people were coming to realize that whether or not they happened to support these regulations, the fact of the matter is that they had lost their ability, or they were losing their ability, and quite rapidly, I'll point out, to determine their right to make those regulations through elected officials. That's what government's all about. We're supposed to have people that we elect because they reflect our values to then enact legislation. And in this country, that means operating within the context of a constitution that reflect those values. Not some foreign bureau that has no, we don't even know who they are. They're not, they don't live here. They don't have any real governing authority in the organic sense, in that we didn't elect them to represent us. But yet they're making these regulations, or what they often call guidelines, that affect our lives, that affect our futures. And I think that there was a growing resentment in Great Britain about this. And that's what it was all about. Now, the main trigger in that, of course, was immigration, and that the European Union was telling Great Britain that they had to accept X number of foreign refugees coming in from Syria and other Islamic countries. Now, the British people wanted to control that. They wanted to be able to decide how many refugees would come in, or if refugees would be welcomed in at all. Now, I would suggest to my listeners that whether or not you think inviting refugees into any country, whether it be Great Britain or this country, is good or bad, that's something that you as a citizen, as a sovereign citizen living in a sovereign nation, ought to have the right to decide. And the way you decide it in a democracy, in a republic, is through your elected officials, not through some foreign body. Do we want to have a foreign entity like a United Nations or a World Trade Organization or whatever tell us and tell our government what we can do in terms of immigration policy or in terms of any policies? I would argue not. The people of Britain decided not, which is why they exited the European Union. And I think that Donald Trump is presenting himself as the Brexit candidate in the United States, as well he is. Now, if there's anything that we can learn from Trump, and let's put aside his personal life, which is pretty sordid from what we can tell, and unpleasant, and putting aside his personality, which is not easy to take, the guy's boorish and somewhat of a cad, he nevertheless has presented certain principles that we can either support or reject. And the main principle is this principle of the value of preserving and advancing our rights as a sovereign nation. And of course, one of those rights, and one of those that Trump has articulated, not in a nice way by any means, and quite offensively and rather crudely, but nevertheless, he has taken the position, is the right of our nation to decide who comes into the nation and who does not come in. Now, I would argue that this is a reason to support Trump, because he understands that this is a value for this nation, for any sovereign nation. We all, as nation states, have the right to decide who enters our national home. And to suggest that there's something discriminatory or racist about that is wrong. Discriminatory, yes. We are discriminating against, let's say, radical white supremacists or former Nazis or, you know, whoever. We're saying, or any group that may not have the best interests of America at heart. We're saying, no, thank you. You're not welcome into this country. There's no right to come into a country. But we are saying to others who could contribute, or we hope do contribute, to our national well-being, welcome in. Let's open the door. Donald Trump talks about the wall having beautiful doors. Beautiful, beautiful. All right, he's obnoxious the way he says it. But the principle is there. This nation, like any nation, has a right, indeed, has a responsibility to decide who enters the national home. It is as basic a principle as you, my listener here, have the right to decide who enters your dorm room, or who enters your private home, or who enters your apartment, or who enters wherever you live. You have a right to decide that. You have a right to say to someone, you're not welcome into my home. We have laws that protect that right. Breaking and entering comes to mind. You know, you don't have the right to go into someone's house if you're not wanted. And you as a citizen, as a person, don't have to answer to why you don't want someone to come in. You don't need to answer that. It doesn't matter why. The only truth is that you have the right to regulate that aspect. That's a nation. That's a national issue that's reflected in the individual. In fact, one of the issues that came up at the time of the founding of the Republic, and it's reflected in the Constitution, the Fourth Amendment, I think it is, was that the British were forcibly domiciling their troops into the private homes of the colonists. And basically coming in and breaking the door down and searching, you know, search and seizure was allowed. They could show up anytime they want and demand entry and search your premises, search your property. And it was one of the things that led to the American Revolution. It was one of the, is codified in the Constitution. You have a right to, your personhood. You have a right to protect your property from unlawful, unnecessary, unwarranted searches and seizures. I mean, if someone wants to search your home, they have to get a warrant. And in order to get a warrant, they have to go before a judge and present evidence with regard to why they want to search your home. They can't just say, hey, we want to go into Joe Schmo's home. So we have protections. We protect that basic right. And the reason it's a basic right is because it's a natural right. It's natural to the animal kingdom. Animals understand the right to property. They understand the right to have a certain amount of control over their own space. You know, try to interfere with the space of a dog, and you'll find out very soon and very quickly how important that right is and how basic it is. So when Donald Trump talks about the nation asserting its right to decide who comes into the national home, he is expressing a basic, common sense, normal right that any sovereign nation has. And that if you think about it, it's quite a progressive idea, the development and the furtherance of private ownership of property, of your right to control your own person. I will say for liberals, the principle that underlied the Supreme Court decision Roe versus Wade is based upon this, right? The right to privacy, which, you know, I mean, I think there are some debates that we could have there, but we'll put that aside. Nevertheless, it's the right of the individual to have a certain high degree of control over their own bodies, over their own space. And thus we charge our nation, when we elect officials to reflect our values, to do the same. And I don't think anyone would disagree technically with what Donald Trump said about this, even though he said it in a nasty way that made us all cringe. It certainly made me cringe. And that is that it makes sense to ensure that people coming into the country are not criminals, are not violent, they're not going to attack women, they're not going to be supporting terrorism, where they can go in and start killing people, that we have a basic standard that we can expect people visiting our nation to maintain, just like we have a basic standard when we invite a person to come into our home. We don't invite someone to come into our home so they can rob us, so they can break our property, they kick in our television set. You know, we expect certain standards. They are guests. So when we welcome them in, and then if we give them citizenship and make them, in a sense, part of our national family, you have standards. And that's really all that Trump is saying. And I think that that's something that should resonate with all of us. So anyway, Chuck Morse here at WMFO 91.5 AM, Tufts University, Medford, Massachusetts. Come on down, 855-915-9636. How are you voting this afternoon? Well, not this afternoon, Tuesday afternoon. 855-915-9636. And so we are approaching Election Day, and I think that, as I said, Trump has articulated certain principles that I think are worth getting behind. They do represent a break from the past, just like Brexit represented a break from Great Britain and the EU. They do represent an assertion of national sovereignty, which I think is healthy, and I think it's progressive in the real sense. And I think that it protects American people. It protects American labor. It protects American business. It protects us. We have a right to, Trump has articulated an economic program that protects American labor. In fact, it's the same program that was articulated by Bernie Sanders. Now, maybe they both came at it from different reasons, perhaps, but the program is nevertheless there, and that is to not see the United States embroil itself into these treaties with foreign nations that not only reduce our sovereign rights as citizens, because after all, our Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, says that American citizens, that our Congress, which is our representatives, has the prerogative, the sole prerogative, to negotiate and ratify treaties, both economic and political, with foreign nations. If you sign an agreement like, for example, NAFTA, that turned that authority to a certain extent over to the World Trade Organization, the GATT agreement. So thus, Congress has sold out its authority and did it in 1993 to an international group of bureaucrats who are regulating American trade in such a way that is not necessarily beneficial to American labor and American business. We want to reassert that right under our Constitution to regulate trade in a way that benefits American business and American labor. Trump has said that his business experience would incline him to negotiate trade agreements using American leverage to get a better deal for America, for the preservation of American business and labor. He has said that he wants to reduce corporate taxes, which not only expatriates capital that's kept overseas and brings it back into the United States, where it can be invested in American companies, which hire people. After all, a job is the best social program. But it also further strengthens the dollar and further strengthens the ability of people, particularly people on fixed incomes, to keep more of what they're earning. And furthermore, if you think about the federal government itself and its ability to raise revenue, lowering taxes actually results, according to evidence, and I'll particularly point to the Reagan years and the Kennedy-Johnson years, in more revenue for the federal government in the form of taxes because there's more income. People make a little bit more. There's more job creation. There's more capital accumulation. There's more economic expansion. There's more business expansion. And the result is there is more income. And the more income, the more taxes the government gets. So if the tax is lower, it doesn't mean the government's going to get less money. In fact, the government gets more money because there's more income to tax. So the math works out such that the government actually takes in more revenue. And that has happened every time an administration has cut taxes. It happened in 1981 with the Reagan tax cut, which led to the prosperity of the 1980s and 90s. It happened in 1962 when John F. Kennedy got past the largest tax cut since World War II. That's when Kennedy said, "A rising tide rises all boats," and that led to the prosperity, or contributed to the prosperity of the 1960s and into the early 1970s. And we can go on. I mean, the 1921 tax cut under the Harding administration led to the prosperity of the 1920s. So, you know, there's a good deal of economic evidence that suggests that when taxes are lowered, not only do people prosper, not only is there economic activity, which results in more jobs, and after all, jobs are the best social program, but the government actually takes in more revenue. Okay, let me get out the old binder here and read a public service announcement. But before I do, I again invite the callers. Chuck Morse here, WMFO, launching my program, Chuck Morse Radio, at WMFO 91.5 AM, Tufts University, Medford. You're welcome to join me, 855-915-9636. 855-915-9636. I'm looking forward to bringing into the studio and bringing in by phone, but hopefully live, a very impressive list of guests in the coming weeks, months, and hopefully years as I establish this program. You know, I'd like to bring in students. I'd like to bring in professors. I'd like to draw from the Tufts University community. Okay, grill safety. Summer is a super time to cook. So many tasty kinds of food, including vegetables, on an outdoor barbecue. But some of the worst fires ever in Somerville and Medford, as well as other urban areas, have been caused by grills left unattended on porches. Always move a grill at least 10 feet away from any building before lighting it. Don't even think about using it on a porch, and never, ever, ever leave a lit or smoldering grill unattended. If you observe smoke coming from a porch or building, call 911. If you see people grilling on a porch, call the fire department. You're not being a cranky neighbor. You're a concerned citizen. This is a public service message from the firefighters of Somerville and WMFO in Medford, Tufts Community Radio. And let me just do one more here. This is Rolls AARP Caregiver Assistance. When your loved one needs help getting around, you're more than just a daughter or a son. You are their driver, personal shopper, and finance manager. And then before you know it, you're their cook, personal assistant, physical therapist, and even more. When you start taking care of a loved one, you don't realize the challenge of playing so many roles. AARP understands the many roles you play. And to help, they've created an online caring resource center for the over 42 million caregivers in the United States who are caring for a parent or a loved one. Now caregivers finally have a place they can ask for help. At aarp.org/caregiving, you can find local resources and connect with experts and the caregiving community. Together we can better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving to find resources. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council. Okay, so come on down, WMFO 91.5. What is on your mind? We're talking election, of course. I'm hoping to do an informal poll to ask you who you're supporting, who you're voting for, Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. The number is 855-915-9636. That's 855-915-9636. And see if I can get a little music going here. Nope. Okay. I'm still learning the ropes here in terms of how to do this. In coming weeks, I'll hopefully have all the snazzy technique where maybe I could play a little tune here and there. Okay, back to the election. I understand, and I totally get the fact that people want to vote for Hillary Clinton because they want to support a liberal agenda. I get that. Abortion, gay marriage, transgender bathrooms, I suppose, is an issue for her, although she seemed to have dropped that one. Tax the rich, although I don't think Hillary Clinton will necessarily do that unless Goldman Sachs tells her she can do it. But putting that aside, I get the fact that there's a comfort level there that she's an old-fashioned kind of liberal, cut of the same mold as her husband, as even more so perhaps, certainly as Al Gore, you know, certainly Barack Obama, John Kerry, you know, your good old-fashioned liberal left leader. And that's fine. I get that. But there is a little elephant in the room with Hillary Clinton. And I mean, I guess I'm sorry to bring this up. And perhaps some of my more liberal listeners may not know about this because they're not, they're just reading the mainstream press. But the fact is that Hillary Clinton is in big legal trouble. And that the trouble appears to be so big that this could be like electing Richard Nixon in 1972. Nixon won the election with a landslide, but a year and a half later he was impeached, or he resigned in the face of impeachment. Hillary Clinton has some very bad habits. She and Bill Clinton are involved in the type of corruption that would have relegated any ordinary politician to the ash bins of history a long time ago, probably prison a long time ago. But Bill and Hillary Clinton have gotten away with it for one reason and one reason only, in my opinion, and that is that they have genuflected to the left. They are useful tools of the liberal left establishment, and as long as they make themselves useful, they can get away with this. It's overlooked, it's covered up, pay no attention. There's nothing going on here. So what if they make a few extra bucks on the side, you know? But the level of greed that they're involved in and their willingness to sell out their offices and their positions of influence to make money is unprecedented. That's their power. Their power is their office. And that is a commodity to them. And they use that commodity to enrich themselves. Now, I know that people have said to me when I've brought this up, oh, yeah, Chuck, but they all do it. Well, first of all, no, they don't all do it. I think a lot of them do it to different levels, yes. And I don't think this is a partisan issue. Republicans do it as much as Democrats. But the difference is that with Clinton, it's a matter of degrees. With them, it's an unprecedented level. I don't think it's ever happened quite at this level in American history. Now, let's just do a quick review of the history of it. The Clintons started out small in a small market, and that was Arkansas. As governor of Arkansas, Bill Clinton got his wife on in a very lucrative position as a partner in a law firm, the biggest law firm in the state, where she represented corporate clients. She was put on the board of directors of all the major corporations in Arkansas, including Walmart. And being on the board of directors is a pretty good deal. You know, I mean, you get a nice big fat check every year in the mail, and you go to a few meetings, maybe go to a lunch. She was on the board of directors of, I think, 8 corporations, all right? She got one of the corporations, Tyson Foods, the chief financial advisor for that group, a man by the name of Blair, took $1,000 from Hillary directly and traded it on the cattle futures market in Chicago and turned it into $100,000. Not a bad deal. This was all because Clinton was governor. This is the only reason why the Clintons got these sorts of deals. You know, you had the Whitewater deal. That was a good one. That was a real estate deal in which elderly people could be evicted from their homes if they were one day late on their mortgage. And then the Clintons would flip them to someone else. They made a good bundle of money from that. Their co-owner, James McDougal, went to prison for it and died in prison, ironically, just before he was going to testify. And his wife also went to prison, and Clinton pardoned her as he was leaving office. So I think there's a good deal of evidence to suggest that the Clintons enriched themselves in Arkansas and used their political influence as governor and the governor's wife to gain personal advantage. Then when Clinton got to the White House, they went from the state house to the nation, and they enriched themselves there as well, selling the Lincoln bedroom, selling plots at the Arlington National Cemetery, doing deals with Chinese corporations. This guy, Johnny Tree, is an example. I mean, there was a huge scandal around that. It was actually a much bigger scandal than the Paula Jones, Monica Lewinsky scandal, but because that scandal involved sex and involved lying to a federal judge, it distracted the nation's attention from their dealings with Chinese businessmen and Indonesian businessmen to enrich themselves to a very high level. Then, when Hillary Clinton was appointed Secretary of State, at that point, the Clintons went international. So they started out state corruption, then they went national corruption, then they went international. And it should be understood that this is exactly why Hillary Clinton set up the infamous private email server in the bathroom of their home in Chappaqua just a few days before taking office as Secretary of State, so she could sidestep the regulation that forbids that. And did it, by the way, against the orders of President Obama. The reason she set up that private server was so that she could make these sorts of deals all around the world. Now, Peter Schweitzer, the author of Clinton Cash, has done a very good job of documenting this and with enormously footnoted book, irrefutable evidence that consistently Hillary Clinton used her office as Secretary of State to enrich herself and Bill through this slush fund that they call the Clinton Foundation and the Clinton Global Initiative. These things are huge rackets. And by the way, Clinton lied blatantly during the debate when she said that the Clinton Foundation gives away 90% of their money to charity. That's a bunch of BS. The record shows that it actually gives away a lot less than 10%. I think the figure is about 6%, much less than the standard donations of other foundations. The fact is that the foundation is a slush fund to enrich not only the Clintons, but to spread around their power to their friends and political allies by giving them big fat salaries and by giving them contracts, sweetheart contracts, that pay out a lot and that where money is kicked back to the foundation. This is what the Clintons did, for example, with the hundreds of millions of dollars that was supposed to go toward relieving Haiti after the earthquake. This is why Haitians are protesting outside the door of the Clinton Foundation in Washington and have been there for years. The media pays no attention. Why? Because the Clintons genuflect to the left. They're useful tools of the establishment, so this gets ignored. The Clinton Foundation enriched not only Clinton's friends, but Hillary Clinton used her position as Secretary of State, and this is even more damning, and this is absolutely a part of the private server and coming out due to the WikiLeaks releases, that she used her position as Secretary of State to get these speaking gigs for Bill while she was in office and for herself after she left office, because she was planning a run for the presidency, and that was their, you know, their currency, as it were. That's their power. That's why people gave them this money. Now, organizations like Goldman Sachs and these other corporate entities, they don't just hand out $250,000, $400,000, half a million bucks. They don't just hand it out for the hell of it. They don't just hire a charter, you know, a first-class seating on a charter jet, fly Clinton into a city, pick her up at the airport with a limousine, bring her to a $10,000 a night hotel, give her a fancy dinner so she can speak for 20 minutes, then limo her back to the airport and send her back home on first class flight. No, they don't just do that for the heck of it. They're not doing that just because they like the Clintons or because they're so interesting. That's a payoff. That is a payoff because Hillary Clinton used her office, according to the WikiLeaks releases, to do favors for these corporations. And she was also doing the same deal with foreign governments. This was why several nations got off the terror list, because they had donated upwards of tens of millions of dollars to the Clinton Foundation, because they had hired Bill to come in as a consultant, because Bill and Hillary and or Hillary got speaking gigs out of it, which, by the way, they personally pocketed over $150 million in cash for those speaking gigs. Now, that is unprecedented. Why the left isn't upset about that? I remember in 1989, I think it was, former President Ronald Reagan was paid a lot of money. I think it was a half a million dollars or something like that, to speak, to be flown to Japan to give a speech to Japanese businessmen. And oh, the uproar. How could they do this? He's capitalizing on his former presidency and whatnot. I mean, that's peanuts compared to what the Clintons are doing. And yet, liberals are willing to overlook it. They're willing to look the other way. What does that tell you? Anyway, come on down. We're reaching toward the end of the broadcast. So let's see. WMFO 91.5 AM, Medford. Chuck Morse here, Chuck Morse Radio. By the way, you can check out my books on Amazon.com. Just put my name in the server, Chuck Morse, M-O-R-S-E, like Morse code, and up they come. 855-915-9636. 855-915-9636. 3-6. What is on your mind, Clinton or Trump? Please, I'd love to hear from you. So anyway, you have this phenomenon where they're raking in huge amounts of money from corporations in exchange for using their office and her office, the Secretary of State, to do favors for them. And the New York Times, which is a friend of the Clintons and which is a liberal publication, stepped out of their characteristic role in March of last year to do a front page article about this, where they documented how Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, allowed a deal to go forward by which a corporation that was a front for Vladimir Putin and the Russians, operating out of Canada, was able to purchase upwards of 20% of American uranium stock in exchange afterwards. And it looks like a quid pro quo by any standards. A huge donation, I don't know, $10 million, $20 million, to the Clinton Foundation. Now, that one really stinks because that one involves national security. That's giving the Russians uranium. What it shows, basically, is that the Clintons, whether they be in the governor's office in Arkansas, whether they be in the White House, or whether they be in the Secretary of State's office, which is international, have always and consistently put themselves and their own interests first. And they've demonstrated a tendency to sell their country and sell their power in exchange for that interest. So what does this mean for people who are considering voting for Hillary Clinton as president? What does it mean for the country if Hillary Clinton is elected president? I'll tell you what I think it means. What it means is that all these decades of corruption, of malfeasance, of at least unethical, if not illegal behavior and conduct, and just this tendency to operate above the law, in front of the law, with impunity, all of it is finally catching up to them. You know, as Barack Obama's minister once said, the chickens are coming home to roost. What you have is now the Justice Department and the FBI investigating not only Hillary Clinton, not only the Clinton Foundation, not only Bill Clinton, but apparently several people who are on her staff. John Podesta is under investigation. Several of her aides are under investigation. Now you have Huma Abedin under investigation, and her husband, her estranged husband, Anthony Weiner, under investigation. And these investigations are not going to go away. They involve serious corruption. It's not just the emails. And the fact that, according to FBI Director James Comey, Clinton did send out emails that were top secret, but he didn't think it was worth pursuing as a prosecutorial offense. But that investigation is now continuing with the discovery of more emails. And insiders at the FBI are saying that these new emails found on the laptop of Huma Abedin, which she shared with her husband, Anthony Weiner, these are not old emails. This is new. This is stuff they had not seen before. So, and that there are something like 650,000 of those. This is not going to go away. And so, I would suggest that if Hillary Clinton is elected, and I think she's trying to run down the clock to see if she can get this done before the indictments actually come down, then she probably will be indicted, especially if the Republicans hold on to at least one of the houses of Congress. And it looks like they will hold on to at least the House, probably the Senate. And if she's indicted, then what we're going to have is a situation similar to Watergate. We'll have a special prosecutor appointed, just like Archibald Cox was appointed from Harvard to investigate Nixon. Lawrence Walsh was appointed to investigate Iran-Contra. Well, we're going to start out with Hillary Clinton having a special prosecutor to investigate the Clinton Foundation, the Clinton Global Initiative, and actually anything else they want to investigate. Because once a special prosecutor is impaneled, they can go anywhere. I mean, a good example was Kenneth Starr, who started out investigating Clinton malfeasance with regard to the Chinese businessman, and eventually it morphed into an investigation of not just Monica Lewinsky, but of Paula Jones and all of Clinton's affairs. That's how it works. Once a special prosecutor is impaneled, they can do whatever they want. And so Hillary Clinton is going to start her administration, possibly even before she takes office, if she wins, under this sort of investigation and with a special prosecutor if the Republicans hold on to Congress, and they will. And that is going to just drag the country through the mud. We're going to have to hear about all the lurid details for months. There's going to be hearings and subpoenas and immunity offered and testimony and all the rest. And the thing will just continue to grind away while the world has, while this nation and the rest of the world is dealing in all sorts of problems. You know, I mean, we want to have a government that's in place to deal with that until eventually Hillary Clinton is probably going to be forced to resign or face impeachment. And it's just not going to go away, folks. It just is not going to go away. Now, if Donald Trump wins on Tuesday, there's been talk about, well, will Hillary have to go to jail? And Trump said that in his administration, you know, she probably would be in jail. And by the way, he's been criticized for that by saying, well, is this a banana republic? Do we really want to prosecute our former nominees to office? That misses a point. A banana republic is a nation that gives their ruling elite special privileges. That's the banana republic. Not the fact that someone in high office, someone who is a member of the ruling elite, has to face the same legal system that the rest of us have to face. That's called a republic. That's a good thing. But putting that aside, if Donald Trump is elected, I honestly don't think that Trump is going to prosecute Hillary. I don't think he's going to go out of his way to do that. I think that Trump is going to let the system proceed. He's not going to protect Hillary, which is what would happen if she's herself elected. She'll take steps to try to squash the investigation. She'll take probably extraordinary means to end any opposition. That won't happen under Trump, so the process will move forward. And I would suspect that behind the scenes, Donald Trump probably will ask President Obama in his lame duck waning weeks in office to give the same sort of blanket unconditional pardon to Hillary Clinton that Gerald Ford gave to Nixon after after Nixon left office. And I think probably rightfully, frankly, because I really don't think that this country needs to delve into a former Secretary of State and a Democratic nominee and all the ugly details of her crimes. I think it's enough that she's gone if she doesn't win, and that we're out of harm's way in terms of electing someone who is that corrupt and that susceptible to indictment and that crooked. So that's what I hope happens. Anyway, you're welcome to join me, Chuck Morse, right here at Tufts University Radio, WMFO 91.5 AM. It's great to be back on the air. If you'd like to reach me, you can check out the Tufts University Radio blog site, or the Tufts, I should say, the Chuck Morse Radio blog site, excuse me. And you can check out my books, which are available at Amazon or Amazon.com, Kindle, Amazon.com. I'm the author of many nonfiction books. Just put my name in the server, Chuck Morse, M-O-R-S-E, and up they come. And I suppose the other factor with Hillary, if she's elected, and this is something that's strictly speculative, I have no idea. But, you know, you kind of know what you see. And the fact is that she does not appear to be in very good health. It's not just that she collapsed at the 9/11 memorial in New York last September 11th, but that she just, you know, she can barely get up the stairs. She's assisted, you know, she's looks like she's getting injections from this guy that no one knows who he is that stands next to her all the time. And that, according to many medical experts who have not examined her, admittedly, she probably has a heart condition, and she's waiting until after the election, come win or lose, to go in and have necessary surgery because she doesn't want the image of it. She doesn't want that to get out. I understand that, actually. And but it's a big surgery, and it's a dangerous surgery, and that the fact is that she may not be in good enough health to serve an office, in which case we'll have a President Kane. Okay, so we're reaching toward the end of the program. Let's see if I can actually, I don't know, get up some music here. I don't think so. I'll have to figure that out for next show. But it's great fun to be back in the air. I'm looking forward to having guests in the studio to discuss some of the amazing issues that I've been told off the air by students here have come up in the school. I'm looking forward to that. I want to talk about all the things and just learn all the things that that colleges are grappling with now, culturally speaking. You know, the micro aggression movement, the safe space movement, the gender fluidity movement, all these things, the indigenous movement, the anti-Israel movement. I mean, we could talk about a bunch of things. And I intend to do just that. So I want to thank you all for listening this afternoon. Looks like we're reaching the end of the program. Again, my name is Chuck Morse, as I launch Chuck Morse Radio here at WMFO 91.5 AM, Medford. And you can check out my books, which again are available at Amazon.com. Put my name in the server, Chuck Morse, Morse like Morse code, M-O-R-S-E, and you'll see a whole list of books. I've written about 15 books, 3 of them published, the rest of them self-published. And I'm working on one right now. In fact, my agent told me to wait until after the election to finish the last chapter. So I'm going to be doing that. And anyway, I want to thank you all for listening this afternoon. Let me see if I can bring up music here. That would be ideal. And let's see where it would be. Well, I have all the pots up and yet no music. Let me just see if I press this button. And if I press Riverdale, I think we'll have music. Nope. Well, I don't know what to tell you. We're sort of at the end of the program, so let me just see if I can. Nope. X out of this, and away we go. Here we go. Sound panel, good. There, it's on continuous. and play.